From MidnightAuthor.com.
Childhood. It's what's for dinner.
Yeah, we told our wives to expect us home when we got there.
You got wives, huh? Any kids?
I have.
Just keep thinking how nice it'll be to see them again.
Her parents were doing something she didn't understand. Trusting them can kill you. It was impolite to tell people to stop raping you, so I never resisted. I could see in my mind someone was at the door. It was the same man every time.
Tonight I have a series of strange and unsettling stories for you, all involving, in some form, the dynamic of childhood, and more specifically, perhaps, the horrors of childhood, because I've talked to a lot of different people, and most people, I would say perhaps 90% of people that I've talked to on this subject, have some sort of terrible childhood trauma. And so that is the theme for tonight's show. It is a theme that is recurrent in my work because childhood is such an important thing to our formative years, and it does something very damaging to who we are as people. And if you can imagine a tree, something that is small and it's a sapling and it's beautiful, and there's something that goes wrong and it begins to grow crooked. And as adults, we begin to sort of lean forward and hunch our backs and breathe a little shallower and talk a little slower, have a bunch of these problems. But we can really bring it all back to what our parents did and what their parents did to them and what their parents did before their parents, and et cetera, et cetera. Childhood is so difficult because we don't understand the world, and the adults that do are frustrated that we don't understand, and they put their frustrations onto us. And of course, when we grow up, we do the same things to our children, at least most people. Another curiosity about childhood is that children see the illogical world for what it is. It's our world's crazy. There are so many things about it that make zero sense. And it's the adults who have been in the system for so long and their parents beat them down when they questioned it, when they wondered, what is this really all about? And eventually that beating got the change in psychology that was desired, to comply, to conform. And it's more complicated than that. It's more than just about compliance and conformity and that sort of thing, but I'm making it simple. This is why bravery is such a sought-after trait, or maybe not such a sought-after trait, but it's something that's rare. It's rare in people. And brave people are actually quite frightening because they're not playing the same game that most people are. Brave people are not afraid of the consequences. They're not afraid of being, say, for example, murdered for speaking the truth as they see it. And children are naturally brave because they don't have a sense of self-consciousness, this anxiety that comes later on in life. So children are very brave, and we do something to sort of beat that out of them in this world. So tonight I have a handful of short stories and poems that all involve this topic in some way, some shape or form. And naturally, these stories are uncomfortable, unsettling, dare I say, unhinged. And at the same time, I think there's also a sort of power in these kinds of stories that you don't really get in others. And there's something especially frightening that isn't quite the same kind of fright that you find in other stories. And I think it's because there is something so deeply rooted inside people, something that wants to be expressed but perhaps isn't, some sort of questioning of reality, some sort of just why. Why are things the way they are? And so I present to you tonight a few frightening scenarios.
See no evil. Martha doesn't want to sit down. She eyes her father from the stairs, sees her mother walking back and forth in the kitchen. She knows all too well what tonight is going to be. Martha, her father calls from the dinner table, not looking up from his newspaper. We had a long talk earlier about what happened. She sits frozen in the clammy silence. You can come to dinner now, he continues. There's no use trying to hide. From behind her, a thump sounds at the top of the stairs. She turns to see her brother looking down at her. She knows he can only see the terror showing through her face. He croaks, slowly descending the stairs, each step thumping like the slow gong of a tribal drum. She can't move. Darling, her father pushes aside his newspaper with an elbow. Our daughter doesn't want to eat with us at dinner. Mother looks at father, a grave expression sinking into the wrinkles of her skin. She stops the burner and looks up at her daughter. Martha can't tell if it's rage or sadness flickering behind her mother's eyes. You know what has to happen, father says. Mother closes her eyes. It's the only choice we have. Martha looks to the entrance, a space the outside world would call quaint and comfortable. He had already gotten mother to put the chains over the door. The curtains are shut fast. She knew something had gone wrong when her phone upstairs was disconnected. The landline cable severed. Mother must have done it in the afternoon before she got home. Martha flinches as her brother grabs her from behind, wrapping his long, lanky arms around her torso, and drags her off. She'd heard sounds from her parents' bedroom that morning. That's where this all started. She'd continued getting ready for classes, gathering her things, and almost didn't think twice as she left through the back door. But as she walked through the garden, around the corner of the house where her parents' bedroom lay, she heard the sounds even louder. She saw in through the window, and her parents were doing something she didn't understand. And whatever it was, the sounds, the shifting and the darkness horrified her, but she couldn't look away. Suddenly they stopped. Her father saw her and she ran. They'll probably think I was just passing through. If they ask, I don't have to tell them anything. But those words were no comfort to her the rest of the day, as the lump in the back of her throat continued to rise. As her brother holds her down in her chair at the dinner table, the lump feels like it's about to block her breathing, her heart pounding like a freight train. You remember, Martha, what Jesus said. Martha can only stare at her father as he gets up from his chair. Mother brings out the sick bowl, the one usually reserved for when the flu is in season. There's a large spoon sitting at the bottom of it. Christ stood at the top of that mountain, and he preached. Father looks at her with piercing eyes, and she anticipates the sermon that's only just beginning. He adjusts the collars around his prosthetic hands without blinking. Brother continues to hold her down as mother walks around the table to her right side, reaching for the spoon. Christ said, it's better for part of you to be thrown away than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Mother is mouthing the words in unison with him. Martha glimpses the stump of her severed tongue that peeks from behind her teeth. So if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out.
When you're beaten down to a bloody pulp by the side of the road, melting under the sun, who do you call out to? When no one's around and all your friends are dead, and you see the buzzards circling, who do you call for? When the wolves are watching you through your windows at night, and the hounds are knocking on the door, and there isn't a crumb left for you to eat, whose name do you scream? When it's all too hard, what do you reach for? A drink? Smoke? Or maybe a picture of mother? The woman so bad she scared off your dad. And that's the God you serve? And every woman since is always a little like her. And when she's gone, you're lost to the sinking wreckage of your life, and the winds howl and the icy hands of the sea scrape against the rotted boards. And as you lay there, rotting away, no purpose, no patience, just dreams in a hellish bed you don't mind sleeping in, you cry out to your God as the flesh crumbles away. You cry out as the sun sets on your life, and nothing you ever do will live up to the cruel and wicked woman who took credit for your life. And you cry out like a 100-year-old infant, holding clumps of your hair in your hands. You cry out for the sympathy that poisons you. You cry out for the hatred she calls love. You cry out for mother to fix your life. As you lay there dying, just like she died. What happened to you? You lied again, but this time mother wasn't going to let it slide. What happened to you? She scolded and reached for a spoon on the kitchen counter. You were only 6 at the time, not enough years to anticipate what was coming. She turned on the burner, held the spoon to the cool blue flames until it glowed. Then she made you open your mouth. When you got to school the next day and the teacher saw you couldn't talk right like you used to, she asked, "What happened to you?" It was too complicated to explain. You said you were sick, and no one questioned it. 2 weeks later, after Father had his morning share of vodka, he coaxed you into your bedroom. He closed the blinds nice and tight and asked you why you weren't making any friends at school. When you had no answer, he beat you over the back with a wrench he'd brought home from work. For the first time that night, you didn't even want to cry. You lay there in the humid dark of your room, cockroaches scuttling around the bed, and listened to the incessant barking of the neighbor's dog, that stupid mutt. Later that year, your mother found a lump on her back that was making it hard to sleep. She decided she'd live with it. On Christmas Eve, several years later, you didn't expect anything under the tree, but you couldn't sleep anymore. At 4 in the morning, you wandered into your mother's room and found her dead. She'd left a spoon and a glass of water on the nightstand, and you remembered how she wouldn't give you a glass of water after what she'd done. You dumped the glass on her face, and after your father found out, he wouldn't utter a word to anyone. A week after your 18th birthday, after Father came home from work, he went into the backyard. He smoked a cigarette and listened to the radio. After he'd smoked it down to the filter, he got his pistol from his closet and blew his brains out.
When you found him laying there, fragments of his skull shattered over the porch, you called the police and walked away. You never looked back. 30 years later, your eyes are surrounded by pitch-dark circles. When people see you on the street, they always ask, "What happened to you?" Even though your father's wrench ensured you'd never walk straight again, you'd found a job at the lumber mill pushing papers. You decided pretty women just aren't in the cards for you. When they see your face, even the most skilled liars can't hide their wincing. If they'll even talk to you, they ask, "What happened to you?" Next door to your crummy apartment, the old man's dog yaps endlessly. That Christmas, the old man gave you the keys to feed the dog while he's out visiting family. One night, at 2 a.m, you grabbed that yapper by the throat and twisted his head off. Your neighbor won't talk to you anymore after that. Another day, you get the idea to visit the school you went to growing up. You watch the kids coming back from Christmas break, and that gives way to all sorts of fantasies. And after the police find you, and they put your face all over the TV and newspapers, the world is left wondering, what happened to you? You watch from prison as the news anchors laugh. He was probably born that way.
The stories that you just heard are fictional. Well, mostly. And I say mostly because the story that you just heard, What Happened to You, is inspired by real people. Several years ago, I collected testimonials of many people's childhoods and the most horrifying things that they had experienced in their childhood. And essentially what I did was combine them. And yes, there have been children whose mothers have taken spoons and heated them up and seared their tongues. A lot of people think that this world doesn't exist, this world of what really happens behind closed doors, what parents do to their children. And some people appear totally normal on the outside. They seem well-adjusted and kind to others. And yet, deep below the surface, there are these moments of impatience that come from parents. And with some people, you don't see just how warped they've become until it's too late. These next stories that you're about to hear are not fictional. In fact, they are completely nonfiction. For my poetry collection, Uncivilized, I wrote several poems that are, in fact, direct recollections of things that happened to me at various stages in my life. So I have been asked several times now if these stories are in fact real, and I just have to say for the record that they are. And part of the reason I was interested in telling these stories in the first place was because I saw that people didn't always see these kinds of stories from afar. Some of them saw these things, heard about these things, and they saw themselves more than anything else. Because I think a lot of people can relate to these kinds of events, and maybe some more than others. And I think you'll understand why I say that when you come to the third poem, Sage and Smoke. People don't talk about this world, but it's very real. And so I'd like to introduce you to a few glimpses, a few slivers of a childhood unseen.
Trial by violence. A young me didn't understand the American justice system. My mother said, "When a conflict happens, it is your right to be heard by a jury of your peers." I thought about my peers. "That sounds awful," I said. "Why on earth would you say that?" She didn't understand that I understood my peers. One day, when I was in the second grade, we were learning the science of sound. The class was divided up into groups, and we were given stethoscopes. I had the stethoscope in my ears, and the girl next to me pulled the diaphragm from my hands. and started banging it on the table. Thunder clapped inside my head, and the shots scraped in my eardrums. I don't know why she hated me so bad. I told the teacher. The teacher asked us both what happened. She said she didn't do anything. I explained. The teacher said she has no reason to lie. So what happened to me was my fault, and I was now in trouble. Some of the kids realized they could have fun torturing me. They would laugh to see me in pain. It didn't matter. This is hell. So no, I thought, why on earth, knowing what I know, would I trust my peers to act in my best interest? The adults didn't seem to get it. I saw men on death row. The system didn't realize they were innocent until after they'd been murdered. I saw people commit terrible acts, only to be set free. I saw teachers take their problems out on their students. I saw adults pick favorites. And I saw formless crowds ready to kill anyone who thought differently from them. In elementary school, I saw how nobody was trustworthy. I didn't realize until I was older that what I saw in my peers was really the parents of my peers. But even all these years later, I still wouldn't trust them, because trusting them can kill you. Every tree. Every tree has its roots. You can't always see them, but you know they're there. Not every tree is beautiful, but some of the ones that are have very ugly, knotted roots. The children sit on them and enjoy the quiet and the shade. One day, my mother took me in to get a haircut. I hadn't been going to school, because school was making me sick. I didn't realize before it was too late, but my mother had told everything to this hairdresser. She was old and slow and wouldn't shut up. She'd spend an hour on one client, and I don't know how she did it. I can't imagine I really wanted a haircut anyway. She didn't even do a good job. I think the only reason my mother even patronized her business was social pressure. I sat in the chair, and for the next hour, this old woman grilled me. I don't even remember what she said. It was like a stranger sorting through your underwear drawer. My mother watched from the sidelines and said nothing. The interrogation continued, and I started to cry. I'd never been told how to say no. Saying no came many years later. It was like getting raped with your parents' permission. In many ways, I was raped. It was impolite to tell people to stop raping you, so I never resisted. I felt like I was always wrong. The old woman didn't understand the words I used. She didn't have the same vocabulary. She had no business knowing what she knew. All she did was prove that I couldn't trust anyone. She held the mirror up to my hair when she was done. "How does it look?" she said. "Good," I said, but I didn't recognize myself. She'd cut my hair in a way that made me look like a bully. To survive being surrounded by liars, I became a liar. To survive always being watched, I hid myself. Everything my mother found, she'd use against me. Everything my mother found would be twisted and distorted and whispered to the whole family. It was like strangers sifting through someone else's underwear drawer that they thought was yours. It was like people deciding exactly who you were and sentencing you to their own hellish idea of your future without knowing you. This is a wicked forest we're all in. Wicked trees growing from sick, worm-eaten roots. The nights are long and the beasts roam between the trees, devouring whoever they may find. I don't know how many of us will be left, but I know the woodsman is coming. Every tree will have its time to be cut down, and any tree that is sick, weak, rotten, will be thrown into the fire. So grow up towards the heavens. Don't look down as you reach out with your arms. Where you came from is not important. Grow without looking to see how tall the trees around you are. Grow without a thought toward time or place or who or what. You're not the one who planted the seed. You're not the one who put you where you are. A tree that is wise knows it has no reason to run. A wise tree knows that running is not its nature. A tree knows that it cannot stop the fire. The wise tree waits, no matter what may come, and watches, and doesn't think about it. Sage and Smoke. Everyone seemed to know our apartment was haunted, but they avoided talking about it. I had a friend over. We talked, drank coffee, ranted about the movies. After the weekend, he was back on the road home. "That place is definitely haunted," he told me months later. "Something about the hallway, the other bedroom on the corner, and the bathroom. What the hell was it with that bathroom?" I would have intrusive thoughts, sometimes in the form of images. I saw a man nailed to a cross like Jesus, but his head was the rotting skull of a goat. I saw the maggots. My skin itched, but there were no flies. I could see in my mind someone was at the door. It was the same man every time. He hid in the entrance, around the corner and under the stairs, and when I was alone, he'd walk up to the peephole and breathe slowly. But I never really told anyone about it. Then one day, my mother walked into my room with a large, round spray bottle. "This is sage," she said. "I want to spray it in that corner." Years before, she'd had conversations with a clock radio that turned on and off by itself. She talked to it as if it were her dead father. Then she said it was demons. She had a friend take the radio so it could be blessed by a priest. Before the priest could say a word, the radio fell from his hands and broke. So the radio wasn't a problem anymore. A while later, we moved an old TV into that room. It eventually became my room. The TV would turn on by itself, and the volume would crank up to the highest setting, and the walls would shake. She had another friend drop it off at the dump. "We need to cleanse the demons," she said, shaking the little bottle. I wanted to tell her to get the hell out, but I simply said, "No, I'm busy." She disappeared down the hall. A few days later, she snuck into my room and sprayed the little bottle in the corner. By then, it had been years, and that TV had been long gone. She would sneak into my room and rearrange things while I was away. I would go to bed feeling alone, violated. Sometimes I would come back into my room and smell sage. Eventually, she couldn't pay the rent, and I left. After that, I found myself in fearful moments, but I was never spooked the way that apartment spooked me ever again. "That's crazy," my friend said after I told him everything. He went off to bed. I lay there on the couch while something scratched on the back door of the house. It was almost Halloween. I slept soundly. Many people wish that they could get more out of life. They feel like they're trapped and seek to find some way to escape it all, some sort of magical solution. And this story that I'm about to share with you tonight is all about that. The Butterfly Collector was a story that I wrote probably around 2017, and I finished it in 2019 for my first collection, The Mirror Opened. It was a concept that was so strange, I wasn't quite sure what to do with it. But that's exactly why I'm often driven to write stories, is because I don't have a place where it fits concretely. It's a concept that's so off the wall, and yet it feels familiar, almost like a kind of fairy tale. And deep at its heart, I think this story has a lesson that
anger at our situation, resentment at the people around us, and trying to find some sort of way out can often lead us into more trouble than we ever expect, and can lead us to very dark, dismal places. And strangely, those dark and dismal places are often veiled by a kind of self-deception, something that's so sinister and so deep within the person that perhaps they even fail to see just how far they have fallen. The Butterfly Collector. The old fat woman lay asleep on the couch. Miriam thought of all the ways she wanted to kill her. It would be easy enough if only she could grip her fingers around the greasy knife, greasy from the fat woman's bloated little hands. She could slide the blade right in with a little caution. Heck, if she could do it fast enough, there'd be no reason to worry. No one would hear any screams. Miriam scrubbed at the dishes, grumbling as she set yet another slightly less soiled plate to the side. She wondered what her face would look like if she smashed one on the old woman's head. Would her wrinkled, cataract-riddled eyes open with a look of fear? Or would they not even care at all? So tempting, yet there was no way she would actually do it. Though she hesitated with the plate in her shaking hand. Around the corner, she could hear the fat oafs wheezing. Perhaps there had been a time when she was younger, and her sleeping was pure, distilled silence. Miriam had a hard time imagining her aunt having been so young, but surely she must have been. One day, long, long ago, she had been young and pretty, slim. The time had worked its vengeance, and now her flabby skin and drooping eyes complemented her bitchiness. Perhaps that was the final blow of justice. All the boys hither and thither wanted their own appointment inside her pants, and now, the few times she left the home, nobody ever paid her mind. In fact, they averted their eyes at the sight of the old hag. It was just as well. All she did anyway was sleep and occasionally bark her orders from the couch. There were a few occasions where Miriam saw her get up from her spot. The plaid fabric was stained through with brown and black splotches, and it stank up the whole house with an indescribable putridness. Thankfully, time had dulled her senses, so she seldom noticed it these days unless she had the displeasure of getting too close to the couch. Sometimes the filthy bitch had trouble getting up, so Miriam had to grit her teeth and walk her over to the bathroom. The house had four main rooms. There was the kitchen, of course, a poor excuse for a dining room. The living room, complete with access cable on an ancient TV set, and then there was the single bedroom and bathroom. The bedroom had once been the aunt's dwelling, but a long time ago, how long Miriam couldn't be sure, the pull of the television called for a semi-permanent move to the couch. It had been downhill from there. And damn if Miriam didn't just want to pack a few pairs of clothes and run away some night. "But, dear, you can't leave," her mother said over the phone nearly a year ago. "Your Aunt Sophia is sick. How do you expect her to do anything on her own?" Miriam would have rather screamed. "Why do I have to deal with this shit? So what if she's old? They have special homes just for people like her." But it was too much money. Too little time, too many distractions for a good excuse. She was locked inside a filthy house with the filthy animal her parents lovingly called your poor aunt. God, how she wished there was a nerve in her to do it, to release herself from this living purgatory. I need ice, Aunt Sophia said. Miriam grumbled and complied. I need someone to empty my ashtray, Miriam. Another grumble, and it was done. Then one day the air felt different. It was sour, with a new kind of horror that was waiting to be discovered. After convincing herself she had no option but to leave her room that morning, and after a few minutes of aggressive scrubbing, Aunt Sophia had a new order. Where are the photo albums at, Miriam? She was still whiny, but there was something else behind it. Upset, perhaps? Miriam thought it unlikely. Photo albums? What do you need them for? Bitch, she coughed. Don't get smart with me. I didn't ask for your questions. Where are they at? Scrub, scrub, scrub. Clatter. I don't know. It's been a long time since I've seen any of those. The garage, maybe? Scrub, scrub. Well, they damn well better be somewhere. I didn't keep all of them for nothing. Nope. Not for all your pointless life, Miriam thought. When there was nothing more aside clatter in the kitchen, Aunt Sophia continued. Your Uncle Gordon would have wanted us to look at those. They meant so much to him, to us. I think we need to find them. Yeah, that would be nice, said Miriam. We should find it so we can look at everything together. A little family time. This was a cue that Miriam knew she had to take, though sometimes it was fun to ignore, just to hear her get pissy. Family bonding time. On that stinky couch. She'd have to confine herself to the shower afterwards unless she could manage to wriggle her way out of it. It had been a long time since she'd made a good excuse anyway. I'll look for them tonight. I have to fill out some paperwork for the state, and I think we need more groceries. There was the fuzzy, static hum of the television. No one so much as breathed in the living room. Aunt Sophia stopped listening before Miriam could even reason a good sleuth. That would make evening errands much more enjoyable, seeing as the hog couldn't be bothered to come along in that state. The cow just wanted her ice cream and freeze-dried fruit, and it was as good as a tranquilizer. Miriam would spend the next 15 minutes scrubbing, and then she would discreetly grab her bag before leaving. Maybe, just maybe, she would have some time to herself. Once she was done scrubbing, and as soon as she placed the last knife into the rack, she walked off to her room. Aunt Sophia didn't even notice. Miriam dialed a cab, and after a few minutes of debate with a dispatcher, a disturbance she'd grown used to, they finally sent a car. Said it would be there in an hour or so. For a change, she decided it would be nice to wait outside rather than in her room. It was one of those days in June where the air was unseasonably chilly, and it would be a sin to spend all of it choked up in this residential gullet. And thank God Aunt Sophia didn't have a word to say about it. Miriam slid out the front door without so much as a creak. Out went the keys, and the door was locked. Outside was a labyrinth of white picket fences and endless rows of homes that, while cleaner, were just as dilapidated and drab as the place she called home. Buildings stood like bored sentinels. There was the occasional pine tree, and they always seemed to have birds chirping in them midday, but this evening was blanketed with quiet. Miriam knew that somewhere out there was another place. It was much happier, a place of solitude where no one would scream at her for ice or beg for extravagant dinners. But the idea of escape was clouded over and so distant. She knew that it had to be a fairy tale, The sun hung in the sky, sinking lower and lower like a dripping egg yolk. And she was starting to wonder just how long before the damned cab was supposed to pull in. The aggravation had worn a groove into her so deep with the repetition of this day each week, only different in minor ways from all the previous times, it was enough to scream. But she sat defeated. 20 minutes? 30? That was half her time for shopping gone. She could already feel the hog's wrath that would be there as soon as she'd cracked the front door open again.
Where the fuck were you, Miriam? I've been worried sick about where you've been. Are you trying to run away from me?
Just as easily, she could imagine kicking the hog's teeth right out. If she planted her foot just right, it could even be fatal. But she didn't have luck or a true gruesome desire. It was all just imagination. Self-therapy, even. A healthy thing for trauma. Well, perhaps in moderation. If she was going to avoid the wrath, she would have to do so on foot. The sound of her shoes clacking on the concrete, as soft and understated as she was, echoed off each neighborhood house without provoking a soul. Not even dogs to bark at her presence. It was as quiet as this town ever was. At first, he looked like a shadowy splotch growing from one of the pine trees a few yards down, so she didn't think to pay him much attention, thinking him just a part of the scenery. But the splotch moved, and as she neared the tree, she could see the crisp fold of his collar. Wine-colored overcoat, gray shorts, and knee-high socks. There was no hat to cover his hair growing full and dark. A schoolboy, Miriam thought. If he had been wearing one of those woolen flat caps, she would have thought he'd walked straight out of a vintage family portrait. He was holding a picture frame, almost about half his height, looking at it with a fierce, transfixed gaze that would have been startling had it been directed at her. But when he looked up, the fire in his eyes calmed to an inviting warmth. "Hello, Miss Miriam." She wanted to ask how he knew her name, but all she could say was, "Hi. I'm sorry, have we met somewhere before?" "I don't think so, miss. But I've seen you around here. You're very pretty." "Why, that's nice of you to say. I'm sorry, you've caught me a little by surprise. I'm supposed to be in a cab now, but it seems they've forgotten me." The boy hesitated. "That's not so bad," he said. "If the cab had come, we wouldn't be talking now, would we?" "Not like this, anyway." "I guess not." She wanted to keep walking, but her heart couldn't bear to, with the child looking at her. There was something she liked about him, and another not-so-pleasant something she couldn't place, though it could have easily been her own stress. "And what's your name?"
"Nick," the boy said.
"Ah, Nicholas, that's a nice name."
"It's just Nick," he said, without a hint of amusement, looking down to his picture frame again.
"Well, Nick, where do you live? I don't think I've seen you here before."
"I travel around a lot.
Not really a lot of time in one place. I'm a few houses over. At least until Father moves us along. He's not very happy with me." That was the thing about children. Miriam knew they could be open books, but at a certain age, a child learns the art of silence around family when the home is disrupted for long enough. If she decided to dismiss Nick, she would be leaving him alone to his reality, and perhaps it was the unspeakable. A family that moved often was almost guaranteed to be dysfunctional, from her experience. For a moment, she forgot all about the wrath, the fear. Instead, she found herself fixed on the child. And no, she couldn't leave, not knowing that. I see you holding that there, she said. What is it?
Just what I do to pass the time, Nick said.
And he tilted the frame so she could see what it held. Butterflies. Gorgeous, vibrant wings of all colors, spread for display and pinned by a careful hand. She had never seen colors that bright outside of stained glass. Like the windows of the Catholic Church Miriam visited as a child. Now she knew why he'd been staring so intently. You made that yourself, Nick, she said. It's beautiful. Thank you, Miss Miriam. I'm glad you understand. My father gets very upset with me and my collection. So that's why I come out here, so he can't see. I want to cover the walls of my basement with these and keep them forever. That would be marvelous, don't you think?
It certainly would. Where did you learn to make something like that? Did your mother teach you?
His eyes narrowed in disapproval, and his voice came out cold and unflinching.
I learned this myself. It's what I do.
The change was almost as frightening as the hog's wrath, but she knew better than to take it personally.
Oh, I see, Nick. I didn't mean to offend. It's just, you're very good at what you do. And I want to learn about it, that's all. He didn't have anything to say to that. And when the silence became too much, she said, Do you have your net with you?
A net? Why would I need that?
To catch butterflies, she said.
He became filled with realization.
Oh, no. That's not necessary. You know, you don't seem like you have a very happy life. I can see it in the way you dress, the way you hold yourself.
Why would you say that, Nick?
The way you look when you're leaving the house. You don't seem very happy, Miss Miriam.
Things could be better.
No, I guess you could say the same for a lot of people.
Don't kid yourself, miss. I think we have a lot more in common than you think.
It set her on edge to think about the hog. Life at home, it was all better as a secret. But worst of all was knowing that he was right. Maybe there was something to the way she held herself, her choice of attire, almost always on the worn side, if only because the hog was so obsessed with conserving every penny. He could read her like an open book. And though it could have been alarming, the sense of reality brought relief. Yes, there are problems at home, and yes, I desperately want to leave. For the first time, she didn't feel so crazy for thinking that way. This time, she took her turn remaining in silence.
If you want to, why don't you just leave, Miss Miriam, he said.
I suppose I could, but
no. No, it would be too complicated. Emotional. A lot of people would be very unhappy with me if I did that.
The boy looked her over head to foot, then turned his gaze to the burlap sack at his feet that leaned against the tree. He reached a pale hand down to pick it up, loosened the rope holding the sack closed, and put an arm inside to rummage around. He hesitated, feeling the object he was looking for, and removed a small plastic gun to hand it to her. It looked ordinary as a plastic pistol might, with its telltale orange cap sticking out of the end of the barrel. Miriam never thought Nick to be the type to play with those kinds of toys, but then again, today already held plenty of surprises. Go back home and shoot this right at the trouble. Pull the trigger, and they won't be real anymore.
I only wish my imagination worked that well, kid, she thought. But it was endearing to see a child so full of creativity.
Are you sure you want to give that to me, though, Nick? I wouldn't want to take something of yours. And besides, I think your parents would be upset if they found out you were giving your toys away.
Again, the fire in his eyes burned a subtle rage. I'm sure it's none of their business. And besides, I'll come back for it later. This is what you want, Miss Merriam. This is what you need. All right, I can play a little make-believe, she thought, and took the gun from him. It was heavier than she thought it would be, and chilled to the touch. Well, Nick, thank you for this. I guess I should be headed home now. It's getting late after all. Don't worry, Miss Merriam. I'm more than happy to assist. Be careful with that. He smiled and nodded. And God, that kid has a vocabulary. She turned to the direction she had come from, taking notice of the long shadows that had grown since they'd started talking. Soon there wouldn't be any sunlight at all, and that spelled a nasty argument that was waiting just beyond her front door. Nick was on her mind with each step back. Such a strange kid, she thought, but alluring no less. Clearly he was intelligent, and that charm of his would do well for him in time, if only they could have kept talking. That in itself was a special kind of escape. Now her fears took the forefront of her mind with the knowledge she would be home late, and worse yet, without anything to quell the hog's emotions. She decided, if at all possible, she would avoid entering the house in a way that would make her presence known to her aunt. But when she reached the driveway and the gate that allowed the passage into the back garden, the latch had frozen in place from years of rain and neglect. Pulling it apart would have been far too much racket. The next best option would be the front door, and to be as silent and stealthy as she had exited before. She stood at the door holding the knob, filled with trepidation. But you have to, she thought. You have to buckle up and make your move. She opened the door. Against her hopes, her wishes, and prayers, the hog was already waiting for this exact moment.
Merriam, where the fuck have you been, Missy? It's been almost an hour and you haven't called. You didn't even say goodbye. So why don't you own up to it now, Missy, before I call your parents? And what then, bitch?
She hadn't expected to say that.
I'm sorry, what did you just call me? You're not going to get away with this shit, Missy. I can call your parents anytime I want, and I'll tell them just how much of a fucking whore you are.
What?
That's right, you fucking whore. I'll tell them. That's what you do all day, sneaking out of the house when I'm not looking and spreading your legs for every damn boy in this town. I'm not stupid, and I'll tell your folks about the baby, too.
There wasn't a single rational thing to say to that. Though she searched her mind, she felt her face flush, and somewhere in the distance her heart pounded, pleading to be let out of her body, to end the torment, the pain. She couldn't do a thing to hold back the expression that formed on her own face, one of rage, of disbelief.
Who are you? She finally spoke. Who are you to think it's okay to treat your only niece like a goddamn punching bag?
Merriam, against all expectations of herself, raised the gun and pointed it straight at the hog's face, which was now as wide-eyed and ugly as it ever could be. Then it happened all too quickly. Before the hog could throw another verbal stone, Merriam closed her finger around the plastic trigger and heard the pop of a gunpowder cap. The hog opened her mouth, but no scream came out, only a shrill, airy whine of a dying breath. At first, she thought it was shock, or, oh dear God, she's having a heart attack. But the latter was not true. In fact,
Looking down, to both of their surprise, an orange light flickered from a point on the hog's grease-stained shirt. It sparkled and crackled, and Miriam held her breath as the light grew. The hog seemed to look down at herself with a grim understanding, though Miriam knew not what the revelation was. Then a corner of her aunt's cheek drooped down. Her eyes rolled back in her head, and what came next was something she'd only expect to see in an abstract art gallery. Vivid as the screaming faces of Francis Bacon, her flesh drooped, and the skin of her face peeled away in places like molten candle wax, revealing plum-colored networks of veins and arteries pulsing through raw muscle. She watched with a lowering jaw as her aunt's ear curled in on itself and fell off her head, landing on her shoulder and merging with the fat and flesh that began to form a pool on the tile floor and stick to the couch as her aunt tried to stand on dissolving feet. She fell forward, landing on the floor with a muted plop, looking less and less like something that had ever been human. The light spread, and moments later the sticky mess before Miriam had caught fire, and the room filled with smoke and the scent of burning hair. It came with a million thoughts that raced through her mind, but strangely, her heart no longer seemed to pound like it had moments before. For an instant, the air was tranquil. What are my parents going to think? What are they going to do when they see she's gone? Miriam turned to open the door. And there was Nick. A knowing smile stretched across his face. "I told you it would work," he said. Nick crossed the threshold and approached her, taking his gun back from her loose grip, and then nearly trotting to that awful spot where smoke continued to rise and dissipate. He came back holding something that glowed and glittered, vivid lilac that drew the eye. Nick looked at his new possession with a kind of smug glee. A butterfly, bright as a jewel, and just like all the others in his frame. "This is what you wanted, Miss Miriam, right? Isn't she beautiful? She's so beautiful now." Nick held the butterfly up so she could better see it. She was too shaken for an answer, but deep down she thought, "Yes, this is what I want. This is what I've needed." Seeing the stained glass wings and Nick's innocent, youthful smile brought strange reassurance, indescribably calm. He really was a charming boy. "You shouldn't worry, Miss Miriam," he continued. "I'll take care of everything else from here. You can leave now and do whatever you like." "Anything?" she said. It was the only question to ask. The only simple one, at least. "Yes, of course, silly. You're free now. Why don't you take a little stroll outside? Here's really not the best place to be right now. How about some more fresh air for a change?" Yes, fresh air, she thought. It felt just right. Nick grabbed her hand with gentlemanly grace and led her to the front door. She turned to look behind herself on the patio, to see him one last time. He nodded a subtle farewell. "I'll be back again." "You will? When?" "Yes, I will. As soon as I'm finished with the mess, I'll see you later, Miriam. Promise to be my princess?" She wasn't really thinking anymore, just looking into those beautiful eyes. That smile. "Yes, Nick, of course." "Marvelous," he said, and closed the door. Miriam couldn't help but smile, too. As she turned around to see the green and white maze of picket fences and manicured lawns, she felt freedom in the air, that never was before. The creamery was two blocks down and around the corner, and that, she thought, would be just right. There was a vibrant monarch perched on her own picket fence, its wings swaying in the gentle breeze. She wondered how soon Nick would be back and what he would want. But for now, she couldn't convince herself to feel troubled about it, not about him and not about the empty streets. Down the road, a yellow cab lay abandoned, crooked, its driver's side door ajar. She wondered if its owner would be coming back. Thank you for joining me on tonight's midnight presentation. This show is ad-free and sponsor-free, and I plan to keep it that way. It really is better for both of us. That being said, this show is made possible by your feedback and support, so if you'd like to reach me directly with comments, questions, suggestions, or anything you'd like to share, email me at chris@midnightauthor.com. In other news, the blog over at midnightauthor.com has recently seen an RSS upgrade, which means you can subscribe with a feed reader software like you would with this podcast. I've been posting more stories, poems, and illustrations recently, and you'll be able to find a lot more in the coming months. I recently scanned in my entire collection of drawings I've been hauling around for years, so you can expect to see some more of that very soon at midnightauthor.com/blog. Until we meet again on another dark, fateful night, I hope your sleep is undisturbed.